This is an appendix to episode 44 of Pomegranate Health from the RACP. That story discusses the merits of HPV testing for cervical cancer. You'll find the original episode at any podcasting app or racp.edu.au/podcast. This roughly edited appendix contains interview outtakes that did not make it into the published version. The speakers are Associate Professor Julia Brotherton, Medical Director of VCS Population Health at the VCS Foundation, and Professor Ian Hammond, who chaired the Implementation Committee for the renewal of the National Cervical Screening Program. The views expressed are their own and may not represent those of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.
Okay, my name's Julia Brotherton. I'm a public health physician by training, which means I've done a medical degree and then subspecialised in public health. And I've really been working in cervical cancer prevention, I guess for nearly 15 years now, focused very much on both the HPV vaccination program, which, as we know, has been a huge success both in Australia and globally, and also in the complement to that, which of course is secondary prevention via screening. So my current role is as Medical Director of VCS Population Health, and we're an NGO based in Melbourne who has really been running a very large cervical screening laboratory for over 50 years, and in the last 25 years has worked a lot with registries to really ensure the safety of women participating in the screening program. So I guess my interest is not only really in the operational public health side, but also in making sure that the data from the programs is really converted into policy-related research, which means we can continually improve the way that we can prevent cervical cancer.
Just to sort of go back in time for a moment, prior to the renewal program, GPs, nurse practitioners and the general public were surveyed about their feelings towards the program by the College of Obstetrics and Gynaecology. And the paper concludes they expressed concerns about the potential impact of the delay in screening age and the change to the five-year screening program. And in fact, the idea for this story came from a colleague who last year underwent an HPV screen for the first time through her GP. And the GP explained that the new test, was allowed earlier detection and a longer interval, but there were still some questions about whether it might lead to overdiagnosis or overtesting. Have you got any sense whether education about the new program for generalists and the public has been successful, whether this scepticism might still be out there?
Yeah, look, I think it's a huge undertaking to turn around what has been an incredibly successful PAP testing program that we're all really familiar with. And I suppose it's very much, an analogy is, you're not using any piece of equipment in your kitchen from the 1950s anymore. You're using newer technology that is faster, more efficient, more accurate. And that's really what's happening with our screening program here. So, yes, I do think it's been a long journey to try and convey what is very complex information. But I think that there is a great evidence base for this now. And I think the other issue really was the delay in the implementation of renewal, as we know, due to the National Registry not being available on time. I think that probably created an opportunity for more uncertainty. And there was a very deliberate strategy not to, provide in-depth education to practitioners until close to the time of transition to avoid confusion, to avoid undermining the then current program. And I do wonder if perhaps, earlier, more comprehensive communication strategies may have been more effective and have been able to reassure practitioners about what is a very strong evidence base. We're seeing countries all over the world with long-standing, highly successful cytology screening programs transitioning to HPV just because of the strong evidence that it is a more effective way of preventing cervical cancer. And really the question now is not should we be doing it, it is, as you alluded to, how do we avoid over-referral? because there will be some women who have got an acute HPV infection, so they've acquired it recently, and those infections, before the immune system brings them under control, can be quite productive, which means they're producing a lot of virus, and yes, they can be associated with a positive test in our program. And that really is why it's only those very oncogenic types, the 16 and the 18, which have a very high cross-sectional likelihood of being associated with a higher grade, that are sent straight to colposcopy. And the other ones that are oncogenic but usually take a lot longer to develop into lesions or cancers, we retest the woman in 12 months. Just to avoid that over-referral with high grade. And Australia is actually, you know, one of the only countries who's using that partial genotyping as a form of triage. And of course, the other form of triage that we have is reflex cytology. And again, that's really, really telling us who needs to go to colposcopy now and who can wait.
again, in those models from the Cancer Council New South Wales team, even a single round of HPV screening on a self-collected sample can reduce the lifetime risk of diagnosis by around 40%. But let's just touch on sort of maybe unintended doctor-patient issues. So we've mentioned the social and cultural barriers to having a smear done. But also, we should also discuss some of the potential psychosocial concerns that have been raised about HPV testing itself. The infection is almost ubiquitous in sexually active people, but few people have ever been told or have ever had the experience of being told that they are positive for a sexually transmitted disease. So what kind of emotions is that likely to elicit, and how do we navigate that?
Yeah, look, I think we need to be really aware of this issue and very respectful about it. I think it's through no deficiency of clinicians deliberately hiding the truth. I think the reality, as I said before, is that we've been doing pap testing for many decades before we even knew it was related to a virus. So the communication that we've been using around what cervical screening is looking for, what the lesions represent, has undergone a fundamental change. I think in a way, we're fortunate that people are familiar with the idea of HPV due to the vaccination. So I don't think it's a completely foreign concept to them. I think we do have lots of challenges. As I said, the HPV screen we're using is not a test to say, do you have HPV, yes or not? It's related to what type, at what level. And I think there's some nuances in the communication there that clinicians need to be aware of. And particularly talking about the difference between the fact that you can have basically all women in the first few years of sexual activity will have HPV and they'll never know about it. Their body will clear it. It's a pretty normal part of being a human being.
Very few people are aware of that. I mean, from friends that I've spoken to, it's not well understood how prevalent the infection is.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's about saying, you know, you're highly likely that you probably picked up this infection at the beginning of your sexual career, however many decades ago that was. And it's really great that we now have a test that can see that it's still in your cells and we can address any risk that that causes. And it's nothing necessarily to do with recent sexual activity, recent sexual partners, infidelity, any of that.
That was one of the things I read about was long-term relationships and where the hell did you get this infection from?
So, it's a real issue, and it's really important that clinicians understand the epidemiology of this disease. And I suppose the other piece of information that's really important to understand is the epidemiology is completely different in males. Yeah. So in females, we see this, you know, high rates of infection as soon as they become sexually active. You know, it's a mucosal infection, and most people generate reasonable immunity. In males, it's almost like a commensal. Most men never generate sterilizing immunity. It comes and goes. It's detectable. It's not detectable. In most men, it's of no consequence. So the prevalence curve in males is really flat through life. So we're talking about different epidemiology between the sexes. And again, this is not something you'd go into with a patient, but really understanding that, yes, men can be silent vectors of this infection, even if they haven't been sexually active for 10 years. you know, they may still be effectively colonized with HPV that's doing them no harm at all, but, you know, can reinfect women. And that's really why, you know, it's important that this is not a disease of blame and shame like historically it's been, and that speaking confidently to patients about the fact that HPV is actually a really normal part of normal human life, and unfortunately, sometimes some people don't clear the types that really matter, and that's what we're talking about. That's what we're looking for. Putting it into that context as well as you can, and appreciating that people may be emotional or misinformed about it, and taking the time, I think, to try and reassure them about what it might mean. You know, the other issue that comes up, of course, is the issue of latency. And I think people traditionally have not really been clear on whether HPV can be latent. I think we do think that it can be now, and we base this on, you know, the fact that people with AIDS and other immunosuppressed conditions who've not been sexually active for many years, if we look for HPV, we find lots of types, and they do get lesions from them. And that really suggests that it can go to undetectable levels for many, many years, but it can reactivate. So I think that's another, you know, important thing. And I think particularly people in their, you know, in their late 60s or 70s who'll say, I haven't been sexually active for ages. Where has this come from? You know, understanding that it may have been there the whole time since you were 20. and it doesn't matter as long as, you know, we don't find it at levels associated with lesions, in which case we need to have a look and make sure what's going on.
Is there any sense yet what impact self-collection has had on participation? And I know that you conducted a trial a little while ago, even sending collection kits out in the mail.
Yeah, so the IPAP trial was basically comparing our normal method of trying to encourage women to screen, which is sending them a letter and saying, hey, how about coming for a screen, with sending under and never screened women a self-collection kit to their home. Now, it did work in the sense that about 20% of the women did take the test and send it to the lab, but I guess it was limited in its impact because there's still 80% of that target group who didn't. And so the national program, I think, has been quite clever in really realizing that women who are not screening, there are so many reasons why they've never participated. And it's really a conversation with a trusted provider that's ever going to change that. So making self-collection.
So first generation vaccines only target HPV 16 and 18, which are responsible for about 70% of cervical cancers. There are seven other HPV types that account for another 20% of cervical cancers, and the latest vaccines protect against all of those. But in Australia, we use a second-generation quadrivalent vaccine that includes HPV types 6 and 11. How do you calculate whether it's worth switching over to a new vaccine or not?
Okay, so to be clear, as of last year, we're using the non-avalent vaccine in two doses in our routine program. So as of 2018, all boys and girls usually aged 12 to 13 in the first year of high school have been receiving a two-dose course of the non-avalent vaccine, also known as Gardasil 9.
Easy answer.
Yeah. and look, I think it's very important that we realise that this is very much an incremental benefit. The heavy lifting of these vaccines is done by protection against HPV 16. Not only in cervical cancer, but in all the other cancers that this vaccine is protecting against. So your anal cancers, your subset of head and neck cancers, your penile, vulval, vaginal cancers, HPV 16 is absolutely the predominant culprit. So, you know, I think each country needs to consider how much they're prepared to pay for that extra benefit. And certainly you wouldn't pay double. You know, you're going to be paying a small increment because the massive amount of benefit of this vaccine and cancer prevention has already been done by those first generation vaccines.
There was a great review by Karen Canfell. She writes that next generation vaccines can be cost effective compared to first generation vaccines if the per dose cost is contained at about a maximum price of 10% higher than the first generation. And the major driver of cost savings is a further reduction in cervical screening and diagnostic costs. So it all, like you say, it's all incremental bits and pieces. But
It's an incremental gain, and I think it's when you add up all those incremental gains that you get your overall, you know, total bang for your buck in terms of how much cervical cancer you're going to prevent in the long term. Yeah.
There was an interesting recent research from the Scottish HPV program suggests that even the first generation bivalent vaccines provide quite a broad spectrum of protection.
Oh, look, I think the bivalent vaccine is an absolutely fantastic anti-cancer vaccine. It's got a different adjuvant to the quadrivalent vaccine and the nonavalent vaccine we're now using. And that adjuvant produces very robust long-term antibody responses that are much higher. And what we've seen that seems to go along with that is that the cross-protection against types related to 16 and 18 is very strong for the bivalent vaccine. And the Scottish data certainly suggests that they are really having massive impacts on the prevalence of related types, so 31, 33, 45 in their program, almost so that it's equivalent to the nine-valent vaccine. So quite amazing, and I think certainly for resource-poor settings, if your program's targeting cancer prevention, the bivalent vaccine is an excellent choice of vaccine for cancer prevention in a population because its cross-protection is so good.
And we're incredibly lucky in Australia to have such an advanced program. But cervical cancer is the fourth most common cancer in women worldwide. What are the priorities? What's the low-hanging fruit? I mean, you just got back from work in Myanmar. What is the low-hanging fruit in developing countries?
Look, I think it's got to be a combination, really. Obviously, WHO recommends that all countries have HPV vaccination programs for girls aged between 9 and 13. And really, for that generation of women, this is going to make a massive difference globally to cervical cancer burden. However, that's not to write off all the women who are already sexually active and who in many countries have no access to effective screening at all. So as you may know, WHO is currently exploring recommendations and strategies for countries to move towards eliminating cervical cancer as a global public health problem. And really the absolute, backbone of programs in every country will be introducing HPV vaccine and offering an HPV-based screening test. Probably the initial target will be for all women 30 to 49 should have at least one test. And we know that that's going to make a massive difference. Obviously, if you can afford it, doing two tests in a lifetime or regular testing. But we're really lucky. I think the prices of HPV tests are going to continue to decline. They can be done as point of care, enabling screen and treat strategies, which we've trialled in PNG. You can have hybrid models where you use HPV testing and then refer to tertiary centres, greatly reducing the number of women who need to attend. So, from doing VIA, which is not very sensitive and like pap testing needs to be repeated, you can mobilise your VIA workforce to really focus on those women who are HPV positive and provide immediate treatment by inspecting the cervix and making sure there's not a cancer there, visualising the transformation zone and applying treatment. So there's a lot of stuff that's really game-changing, and I think many countries are, because of HPV testing, are going to be able to offer a highly effective strategy to many more women for the first time. And of course, self-collection comes into that too in many, many settings, such as work we've been doing in Malaysia, offering self-collection in incredibly busy clinics, and tailoring the registry software to provide the woman's results by SMS. And obviously the vast majority of women don't need to go on and make an appointment for further examination, but for those who do, the registry supports them to do that, supports the clinicians to know what's happening, who they are, how they can contact them. So tailoring what has been really effective in highly developed countries here into middle-income and potentially low-income countries, I think with the technology we now have, it's all coming together. Vaccination, better screening, better technology for follow-up and treatments. So really exciting times globally. We're not there yet, but I think we now have the tools to really make a difference.
Let's briefly chat about the COMPASS trial published in PLOS Medicine in 2017. an Australian study. This was designed specifically to test the efficacy of an HPV screening protocol in the Australian setting where vaccination coverage is high. Was the concern that in a well-vaccinated population, maybe no one would be coming up HPV positive and that virus-negative lesions might be creeping through under the radar?
Look, not really. You know, there have been concerns voiced, particularly from the cytology community, that there are some negative HPV cancers. I think truly HPV negative cervical cancers are very rare. And what seems to be the case from the data we've looked at is that it's always in the oldest women that you find more HPV negative cancers. Just whatever histological type they are. And probably what's happening is you're diagnosing more advanced lesions. There's probably a lot more degeneration, blood, things that interfere with both good cytology testing and HPV testing. So whether they're truly HPV negative is really not clear. I think the wonderful thing about HPV testing, particularly with, you know, the genotyping we have, is it applies equally to both vaccinated and unvaccinated women. So what an HPV test at the level that's predictive of a high-grade lesion is doing is it's telling me her risk right now. So whether she was only vaccinated after sexual debut, if she didn't complete the course, if she wasn't in the country at the time and missed out, whatever the reason, it gives me a very good indicator of her risk right now. And it really simplifies what we as practitioners need to do rather than having, for example, different algorithms for whether you were vaccinated or not vaccinated.
And if you don't mind my asking, do you have any declarations of interests, we're calling them, not conflicts of interest necessarily?
Yeah, sure. So I do, and that is that I've undertaken two research studies in the last 5 years, one looking at what types of HPV cause recurrent respiratory papillomatosis, and one doing a national study of what HPV types we find in cervical cancer. And for both those studies, we accepted some unrestricted funding from vaccine manufacturers to support the laboratory typing, which is quite expensive, but I have no personal financial conflicts of interest.
And you know, as we discussed in the email, you'll see from my questions, none of this is to kick up any polemics, but I was curious about there's a publication from the VCS validating the latest Roche test. What is the state of play with approved test in Australia, and what are the most widespread, and how much of the research has been funded by parties of interest?
I think it's fair to say that there's the standard for HPV tests that can be used in our program is there's not a list of tests that are approved or not approved. Every manufacturer of these tests needs to very carefully validate their test using a specific criteria called the Meyer criteria, which benchmarks it against tests that are known to be of the correct sensitivity and specificity for screening. So, yes, every time a new test comes in, the manufacturers are looking for organisations who have access to cervical samples demonstrated to be associated with high-grade lesions. And it's extremely normal that organisations across the world will take the donations of those test kits in order to do that research.
Yeah.
So yes, at VCS we do take donations from manufacturers to test their products, but we obviously are just objective scientists about it. We have no vested interest. We don't make any money out of it. It's just to see if they meet the standard for use in our program.
And there was an excellent paper by David Hawkes of the Victorian Cytology Service spelling out exactly those criteria and the lab quality and safety assessments. And
that's right. It's very much set as an objective measure as far as possible. And as I said, the really important thing for doctors to understand is, you know, the HPV-based screening that we now have in Australia, it is really not looking for any molecule of HPV. Because I think patients and clinicians both get confused about that. They go, well, HPV is really common. How can we possibly use it as a screening test? You're absolutely right. It is really common. And that's why the HPV tests we use are very carefully calibrated to be looking for levels of HPV of the most oncogenic types that do have a proven predictive value for those high-grade lesions we're trying to detect through screening, and that's been demonstrated in very large randomised controlled trials.
That's an interesting point you make. It not being a respiratory illness, for example, you can achieve herd immunity at a much lower coverage rate. And I think I read somewhere that even there's estimates that even if you only vaccinated women and not men, you could achieve that herd immunity.
Look, absolutely. And I guess we were all quite surprised. Even, you know, within 2 years of initiating the program in Australia, we were seeing not only massive reductions in genital warts in young women, but also in same-age males. And these boys were not vaccinated, but they were getting a massive benefit, which just goes to show, you know, how much that herd protection factors in at the population level. And these boys were not vaccinated, but they were getting a massive benefit against a vaccine-preventable disease. Quite staggering. And I think it has been amazing how much herd protection we've observed, even in countries with much lower coverage than we've achieved, like the US. You know, it really is quite staggering, and it's a very different paradigm to what we're used to thinking about with, you know, airborne and you know, fecal-oral transmitted infectious diseases, where they obviously spread quite easily.
Yeah, my name's Ian Hammond. I was a gynecological oncologist, and I was practicing from 1984 to the end of 2011. And since after that time, I was adopted, I call it, by the Commonwealth to chair initially the renewal steering committee, it was called. And then I was asked to chair the steering committee for the renewal implementation project.
You were involved in a publication with Karen Canfield's research team at the Cancer Council in New South Wales, which compared 135 permutations of possible screening programs for a publication in The Lancet. Is the system we've got now the champion model? How was that settled on?
Sure. I remember sitting around at one of our first meetings, said, what are the options for the future? And we said, well, we'll just carry on doing what we do. We'll do ordinary cytology, and we'll do it every 3 years. We'll do it every 5 years. We'll do liquid-based cytology every 3 years or 5 years, you know, and so on and so forth. And we'll throw HPV into the mix. We'll do cytology, and we'll follow that up with HPV. Or we'll do it the other way around. We'll do HPV, and then we'll do cytology. And the permutations, as you say, there were 135 different algorithms, unbelievable, to do with age and the testing and the order and structure and so on. And that was what Karen put in her modelling and looked at what the outcomes would be. And in the end, what came up was that primary HPV testing on its own with reflex cytology produced a saving of life and a saving of money. Now, that's very compelling for governments.
Yeah.
And this was a fantastic graph. And there's a fabulous diagonal line that goes through it. It's called the WTP ratio. It's what the government or the public is willing to pay for the test.
Right.
If you were below the line, you were willing to pay. If you were above the line, you weren't willing to pay. And in the bottom right-hand corner is where you save life and save money. And apparently, when you do these graphs, you never, ever get a test that shows benefit in the bottom right-hand corner.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't believe it. And that's actually, I think, what compelled the Medical Services Advisory Committee in the end, that not only was it saving life, but would save money. However, having said it saves money, that's a fantastic concept, but when you actually say to the government, we saved you $45 million, can we use that for
can
something
we hold
else?
On to it for
they
something.
Say, no, it doesn't really exist. That $45 million is sort of in the ether.
Straight faced.
And you can't have it at all. So it was quite interesting.
Oh, gosh. And when that model was projected to the year 2035, it was predicted that incidence of cervical cancer would be reduced by 40 to 50% compared to 2017 rates. 2,006 cases and 587 lives.
Yeah.
The researchers applied similar models to the New Zealand setting and found that the impact wasn't quite so dramatic. What are the important differences between the Australian and New Zealand setting?
Well, the New Zealand setting, first of all, they've already got a 3-year program. Mm-hmm. And that's the major thing. I've actually just been part of a parliamentary review committee. I was invited by the minister to take part in it. And I was one of three people on that programme. And we reviewed their programme. They have a very robust programme.
Well, the numbers I'm referring to are sort of the incidence was going to drop by 15% rather than 40%.
Well, the incidence projected, actually, there are a couple of things. We have, in Australia, we have a much more effective HPV vaccination programme.
Yes.
And the data you're referring to doesn't act in isolation. It acts in concert with the HPV vaccination rates in Australia. I mean, across the country, we've got over 80% vaccination rates. And we've moved now to a 9-valent vaccine with only 2 doses required. That means we'll continue to get this very large effect. In New Zealand, the overall vaccination rate isn't as high, and that's why you would not expect to get quite the same benefit in the long term.
Both screening programs start with a swab, which involves some degree of skill, but it's a little bit more forgiving if you're collecting samples for DNA testing. Can you explain why that is?
Well, 2 things. The first thing is the sample that is required is a sample from the cervix. So the number one is you have to visualise the cervix. And having found the cervix, you then take a sample from it. In the old test, with the ordinary Pap test, the sample was put immediately onto a slide, which was then fixed. So it could then go to a laboratory and be stained and looked at by a cytologist. The difference here is we're now using liquid-based samples. What that means is we take a brush, if you like, or an implement, to take some cells from the cervix, and we put those cells into a fluid. And then the fluid is in a vial, the vial is sealed, goes to the laboratory and undergoes a DNA test, a molecular test to search for DNA. When you mentioned that it's more forgiving, well, one of the marvellous things about this new test is that there is the capacity to do vaginal sampling for HPV in women who just refuse to have a speculum examination to find the cervix. So in order to increase participation in the program, then you can do what's called self-sampling or self-collection of a small test of a swab, using a swab just inside the vagina. And that, of course, is very forgiving because you don't have to get cervical cells. You can just get vaginal cells that have got HPV. And that's the only way in which it's more forgiving.
That's what I meant, that it's such a sensitive assay that you don't need to get down to the cervix to...
Well, correct, except that it's very important that if a practitioner is taking a cervical sample, that they do get a cervical sample. And the reason I say that is because if they write down, you know, I've done a cervical sample, but they haven't actually seen the cervix, then the cytology will not really be reflective of what's there on the cervix. That's all. So, I mean, you're quite right in what you say. It is more forgiving, but it still requires, for the majority of the population, it requires a proper cervical sample with visualisation of the cervix.
Mm-hmm. Since you were just referring to it, can you describe the expertise that's involved in colposcopy and how this factors into questions of, you know, variability and quality control and so on?
The colposcope is just really like a pair of binoculars, a magnifying instrument set on a stand with a bright light. And that bright light allows you to illuminate the cervix. And all one does then is you use some dilute acetic acid or vinegar, and you put that on the cervix, you stain the cervix with this acetic acid, and that denatures protein on the cervix. And the cells that have more abnormality in them tend to, if you like, shine brightly with a white change in the cells. It also, you can see vascular patterns on the cervix, and these vascular patterns combined with the whiteness are recognizable as characteristic of high grade abnormality or low grade abnormality. And in some cases, there are vascular patterns that are very suggestive of having cancer change, true invasive cancer, which could be microinvasive or invasive. Now, generally, this is carried out by gynecologists. And there are specific modules of training within the program. But the real thing is you need to be able to make some prediction of what you think the likelihood is of there being an abnormality, although the positive predictive value is only in the range of 60 to 70% in good hands, quite honestly.
The reason I ask about that is I wonder if that's one of the the major variables in the efficacy of either program. It's not the HPV test or the initial cytology, but it's then how effectively it's followed up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got to have competent colposcopy. So we have benchmark measures of performance, which will be recorded now by the new register. Mm. And I think that's very, very helpful, actually. But what it will identify is doctors who are over-treating people. And I think it's important for several reasons. One of them is, in the old days, before we understood HPV and the effect on the cervix, and I'm talking about myself when I was practicing in the early 80s, we believed, for example, that all histological diagnoses of CIN1, we believed they all went on to become high-grade. So all of these low-grade abnormalities, when they were diagnosed, right, were treated. Now, with further information, we now know that the CIN1, which we saw in histology, is really just a productive HPV infection on the cervix, and these are no longer treated. So the competency in colposcopy is not just seeing things and finding the cervix and taking a biopsy, it's really knowing what to do with the results of the histology combined with what the referral cytology and the referral HPV. It's the management, once you've got to the colposcopy, that's much more important.
In fact, in August last year, the US Preventative Services Task Force bit the bullet and recommended primary HPV screening at a 5-year interval, although they backed down from eliminating co-testing as an option for cautious clinicians.
The reality is that in America, the vested interests in the laboratories are absolutely unbelievable. And nobody disagrees with that. I mean, they say, you know, that it's just amazing. And you have to satisfy so many people to get this across the line. I think it's worth remembering, of course, the United States, they do not have a national coordinated, organized approach to cervical screening. And that is the difference, really, between the states, United States, and other countries.
But back when you convinced the MSAC, the Medical Services Advisory Committee, to go with the renewal program in 2014, yeah. The US was having the same conversation, and I particularly like this comment by Professor Mark Stoller of the University of Virginia Health System, who wrote, "The data influencing these considerations are perhaps some of the most robust in all of medicine. Where else in medicine can one find combined data from published large-scale clinical trials that encompass approximately 1.2 million women in 6 countries? Remarkably, the details of the trial designs vary considerably, yet the conclusions are fundamentally the same, that HPV testing is superior to cytology alone and dominates in terms of clinical performance. Furthermore, the potential contribution of co-testing over HPV primary screening is extremely limited."
I agree with all of that. I agree with all of that. Mark Stoller is a giant amongst the profession, and he's been very sound across the board. Absolutely.
You're never going to know whether you're over-treating or appropriately treating, but listeners might be having a sense of déjà vu with the story of the prostate-specific antigen. In the 15 years after the PSA test was introduced, there was a 43% increase in the number of diagnoses of prostate cancer, and clinicians got a scolding in the media about overdiagnosis.
Absolutely.
And since then, the NHNMRC and the RACGP have been re-educating clinicians and the public with the following message: that for every 1,000 men between age of 55 and 65 who have an annual test, 87 would have a false positive result after an invasive biopsy, 28 would experience side effects, including impotence and incontinence, and just 2 men would be saved from death as a result of screening. And that test has, at clinically relevant thresholds, that test has a specificity of 87 to 94%. So how do we know we're not going down that same path?
I don't think so, because the difference is that when I was a medical student, I remember going to a post-mortem and one of the pathologists saying that if you live to your 80 or 90 and you section the prostate of a man, you will find prostatic cancer. They're never going to die of it. They've just got it. It's there. It's some cells. With cervical cancer, that's not been shown to be the case. It's a different story. If you don't treat high-grade abnormalities of the cervix, high-grade abnormalities detected, you will have significant amount of cervical cancer. If you go to countries where they do not have a screening program, let's say, you know, some of the South American countries, India is a very good example, they've got massive, terrible death rates, incidence and death rates. I think overwhelmingly the benefits of cervical screening have been demonstrated in all the countries in the world that have a program. You have a very low incidence of mortality of cervical cancer. And to me, that's highly compelling. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, women had a hysterectomy if they were diagnosed with carcinoma in situ of the cervix. That is not the situation today. They have a local treatment that in nearly all cases, if appropriately applied, will not lead to long-lasting damage to the cervix. But overall, there's a major, major benefit to the health of women. So to me, it's compelling.
We might have been on the wrong foot. And one of the first things that I read was the letter that Brian Crox wrote to the MJA critiquing the then still theoretical renewal program. And he wrote that the estimates of sensitivity used in the models to justify the policy were syn grade 2 and not for detecting progressing disease. And he pointed to this Finnish research which calculated that the sensitivity for HPV screening for progressive disease was actually 87%. And they conclude that it's mathematically impossible for HPV testing to provide greater protection from invasive cervical cancer than cytology. And you and your colleagues wrote a response to that. I don't know if you remember what you wrote exactly.
Well, I do, because I've got it in front of me.
Do you want to? I like the comments about how the MSAC rejected you in 2002, 2003, 2009, but then finally they were convinced because the paradigm was...
Well, actually, MSAC didn't actually reject primary HPV testing ever. What they rejected was using HPV testing after cytology. So basically, you know, triage of cytology using HPV testing. Now, that actually is current, by the way, in New Zealand. They have that as part of their program for women who are over 30 who have low-grade abnormality on the cervix. On a cytology, they use HPV testing. It's been shown in New Zealand to be almost universally useless because so many of the, I think it's about 70% or more of the women who have a low-grade abnormality tested positive for HPV. So, I mean, that's not helping. You know, you might as well just send them all for colposcopy. It was pointless. But as they're going to move to primary HPV screening, they're not going to look at it now. There's no point. What we did say about Cox's paper, respectfully, is that they used a very highly simplified approach. Their approach rested on the assumption that a negative HPV test provided the same protection over time as a negative cytology test. Well, that's just nonsense. It's just nonsense. I mean, you yourself gave me the evidence from Dillner, from the BMJ in 2008, from the European cohort study, that basically the HPV test is twice as good at 5 years as the cytology is at 2 years. And to me, you know, that's what I'm happy to go to bed at night thinking, well, this is safe for the women of Australia. I have a young daughter, and she's in her 20s, and I'm happy that she will be well served by the program that we have going forward.